You're listening to ABC Overnights. My name's Tim. How are you going? Good to have you along for the ride. Well, let's get on the road now and head to this week's spot on the map. We're at Huonville in Tasmania this morning. Andrew Smith joins me. G'day, Andrew.
How you going, Tim?
I'm really, really well. Firstly, where is Huonville?
Huonville is a small town 42 kilometres south of Hobart. So we're down, we are actually the southernmost municipality of Australia down here.
Oh, interesting. Now, I know that you are very much local. Can you tell us about your connections to the district?
Sure. Our heritage goes way back. I'm a fourth generation fruit grower. We grow apples, cherries, and we have an emerging cider business as well down here. And so we're fully entrenched. Our heritage goes right back to the Oates and then back to the convicts.
Wow, so we're talking, what, 150 years or something?
And we started growing apples on this site where I currently am in the mid-1800s.
So that is amazing.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing. Can you talk to us a little bit about, you mentioned cider in there, and I must confess, I've just been working for the ABC out at Orange in the central west of New South Wales, and of course that's a big apple and cherry district, as you know. But also, one of the things they're starting to go into now is cider also. One thing I've learned recently is that you use different apples, or you can use a different apple because some of the different breeds you might use for cider are tart or can bring a kind of tartar, less sweet quality. Are you looking at different apple varieties down there in Huonville?
Absolutely. You were talking about tannin, so you can. We historically have been making cider out of value-added dessert apples, sweet apples, but in fact now we're looking for higher tannin quality apples to enhance and make the ciders more sophisticated, if you like. So it would be like a winemaker originally making wine out of table grapes and then eventually going to wine grapes, and that's the transition that most progressive cider businesses are currently going through.
So can you tell us the traditional apples you and your family have been growing since the 1850s, and then talk to me about some of the newer varieties that you're experimenting with?
Well, I mean, the industry down here, it has had so many peaks and troughs in this region. In fact, you know, in Tasmania, but largely in this region, was one of the largest apple producing regions in the southern hemisphere in the mid 60s. And then the world changed, and the economy changed, and the European Union was formed, and England stopped importing all the Tasmanian fruit, and the industry went into 30 years of demise. And during that time, it constantly changed varietal structures and growing systems, and whether it's stored and picked, packed and delivered, or stored fruit. So we've gone through the older varieties like Granny Smiths and Democrats, and then into Red Delicious apples, which dominated the market for 20 or 30 years. And now we're into the newer varieties like Gala, Fuji, Pink Lady, and even more progressive than that, there's other varieties like Jazz and Envy and Smitten, and new varieties coming onto the market all the time.
It does sound like it's an area that's so suitable for apples and cherries. Can you talk to us about why that is? I've been reading online that you don't get as much rainfall as the west of your state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look, we're like most east coasts in New Zealand and all around the world, really, the UK. The weather is coming from the west to the east, and it rains out somewhere between when it hits the island and us. Having said that, we get a lot more rain than most parts of Australia, and that actually helps us. So water security is a big part of what we need in fruit production. We have to water the apples and the cherries often, and so the water is actually an advantage to us. So I guess one of the things that created the demise of the industry in the 70s, 80s and 90s was its isolation and distance from major markets in the world, but actually that's fast becoming a huge advantage for us as well.
Now, is that because of fruit fly? Can you explain why that is?
It is. It's too cold down here. We're too close to Antarctica. The fruit flies don't like it. They'd rather be at surface paradise up in the heat. So, it's a temperate climate, not a tropical climate. So because it's temperate, we're not getting fruit fly and fruit bats and other pests that can affect regions like Victoria and New South Wales and even Queensland. So our biosecurity status is relatively good. We have fewer pests that stop us from being able to export to countries like South Korea and China and those Taiwan and those really high value markets in Southeast Asia.
You're talking about apples. Can I quickly steer you on to cherries? Because, of course, that's the fruit that we're all currently eating. Again, from some of my work in central New South Wales, I know that they are kind of the first in when it comes to cherries. Wellington and Young and Griffith and those areas are kind of the beginning of the season, and they're all harvesting now. You guys are a bit later, and I think it is because you've chosen varieties that are that do mature later on purpose, because you don't want to get that, because you get rain kind of in the December area and that's could crack the fruit. Can you tell us about that and the late maturity of your crops and what species or what, you know, what types of cherry you're growing?
Not just because of the rain, also because of the marketing window. So we are choosing those late varieties because we don't want to clash in the market with Orange and New South Wales, but not only that, we don't want to clash with New Zealand or South America in Southeast Asia as well. So we're trying to constantly push back the window of harvest actually into a higher risk weather event potentially. I mean, the longer they're on the trees, the more exposed they are to whatever happens with the weather. So we're pushing them back from a marketing point of view. So we are definitely the Tasmanian cherry growers that are, you know, working and growing their businesses at the moment are looking for late season cherries. As late as February now, we can be harvesting cherries in late January, early February. Some at elevation can go all the way nearly to March. And the advantage of that, of course, is the highest consumption of cherries out of Tasmania is Chinese New Year. And at times the Chinese New Year is very late. It moves every year, it moves a week and then jumps back a month. So if we hit that timing on Chinese New Year from an export perspective, it can be very good for us.
Well, that's late January, is it?
Late January. It goes late January and then jumps back to the first week. But that's where we were pushing for to get that late January market, and it's later than Chile and it's later than New Zealand, and we want to be the only people in the market.
And I imagine they're popular in China at that time because red, the colour red, is an auspicious colour.
Southeast Asian culture dictates that food is not only for consumption. They do a lot of gift and gift packs for presents to people, but also donations to relatives who might have passed away and things like that. So, and they actually want to donate the most expensive and or the best product if they're doing that as a sign of respect, and that has become a really crucial time and a fantastic market for and market opportunity for places like Tasmania.
We've talked a lot about apples and primary production. I know that it's quite popular in that district to invite people to come along and pick their own fruit. Is that something that you've been looking at?
We don't do that. We have a reasonable commercial scale here, and we've got plenty of staff rolling around, and we're trying to, you know, be very good at what we do in our business. So we're not sort of got people coming in off the street. We have a small cellar door as a value add operation where we do our cider, and we get quite a few customers come in, and we talk to them and educate them about what we do at that place. But on the actual farm, we're all business.
Can we talk about Huonville? Because we've gone off into the sort of primary production fruit tangent. Let's get back to the town itself. Of course, in the Huon Valley, what kind of population are you looking at there in Huonville?
In Huonville itself, you're looking at probably slightly over 2,000 people, that sort of scale. And then there's other small towns that satellite off that have, you know, are emerging into reasonable little townships as well.
Tell me a bit about the changing demographics, if they are changing. Is it static? Is it growing? Are you getting more kind of what we used to call hobby farmers or lifestyle blockers?
We are. To the point where I've never seen so much action, to be honest. There's two things that are going on in Huonville at the moment. It's full of coffee shops, and it wasn't so long ago that it probably didn't have one, and now there's probably three or four. And the other flourishing shop front in Huonville at the moment is real estate agents. And we are finding that people are getting sick of the heat, and they're coming to Tasmania to take advantage, and certainly the Huon Valley one, to take advantage of the very safe and easy living lifestyle, and what was a relatively cheap cost of housing. And they're moving out here and, like you say, building their hobby farms and living the dream in the Huon Valley.
I assume Huonville gets its name from the valley.
Yes.
What does it look like as you're driving in? Can you paint a picture for us?
If you're driving out of Hobart, you come over two fairly substantial mountain ranges, both of them a third of the way down and a third of the way down, and they're about 380, 400 metres in elevation that you drive over. And when you come over the second one, the valley actually appears in front of you, and you sort of, you weave your way down the hill on a very good road. Part of the expansion down here was when they put two lanes on the highway coming down through here. So you weave your way down and you hit the bottom of the valley, and it's very sparse with houses and very sparsely populated all the way through until you hit the township, and it's stunning, really. I mean, we love it. It's very hilly and green, and the hills are covered with trees, and the bottom of the valley is covered with cherry trees, apple trees, and nursery trees. There's quite a flourishing nursery industry of young trees as well.
You've talked about some of the primary production that you do there, apples and cherries and such. What else do people do there for a crust? What are some of the other agricultural and other industries?
As the apple industry has shrunk, the forestry industry took up a lot of the slack originally, and forestry's been a big industry in this region. In recent times, forestry's not been, looked upon well in Tasmania, and the issues around fighting over World Heritage listing and what should be chopped down and what shouldn't has changed that industry, and now the emerging industry that's really driving new people into the valley and taking, creating jobs is aquaculture. The Tasmanian salmon industry has got two really, really big players who are both based in the Huon Valley, and they are employing thousands and very soon to employ tens of thousands of people in Tasmania.
You listen to ABC Local Radio. My name's Tim Brunero. Good to be with you this morning. Thanks for joining us. We are in Huonville, Tasmania, talking to Andrew Smith. If you've just joined us, each week at this time, we like to visit a town, a spot on the map, as it were, and find out what's going on, basically. Andrew, what do people do for fun in Huonville?
Well, it really is a lifestyle place. And as I said, we live on the edge of the World Heritage listed area down here, and bushwalking, sailing, things like that are very popular. We've got beautiful waterways not far from here. We're only 20 minutes from the D'Entrecasteaux Channel, which is a great place to, have a boat and operate. Horse riding, motorbike riding, it's all that lifestyle sort of thing. And then when you finish doing that, provenance and wineries and cherry orchards and great fresh produce are becoming very popular for tourists to come and buy direct from the farm gate and or experience in the wineries and things around here as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about tourists, because it seems to me that just from the reading I've done around Huonville, that is a pretty big part of what you do. Can you tell us a bit more about it? How does it work? People come down on day trips from Hobart, and what do they do when they're down there?
They do just that. They come to the cider cellar door. They come to the winery. They experience the Huon River, which is one of the great freshwater rivers left in Australia. It's a huge river system that runs with fresh water from here to the southwest of Tasmania that probably only has five people commercially drawing out of it. It's beautiful, clean water running 365 days a year, and they just experience the tranquility and the isolation. You're talking about a landmass in Tasmania generally about the same size as the UK, well, England, and 500,000 people in total. So one thing tourists tend to love when they come to Tasmania is the isolation and the lack of, densely populated areas.
Speaking of people and the people around about, have you got any famous people around the district?
Well, I don't know of too many famous people around the valley. I know of a lot of people down here who think they're famous, but I might be one of those. But I don't know. There was a very famous opera singer down here called Amy Sherwin, who in the early 1900s had quite, was seen as one of the best opera singers in the world. They dubbed her the Tasmanian Nightingale, and but as far as actual famous, I mean, we've had some sporting achievers, certainly people that have been to the Olympics. Simon Burgess was a very successful rower, and I think he went to three or four Olympics. And we have some very accomplished people, quite a few local football players now playing in the National Football League and things like that, but not super famous.
What's the demographics like? Are you finding that you're getting older people who want to populate those coffee shops, or is it still a fairly young and dynamic place?
It's seen, I'm sure it's seen as a retirement place. I'm sure it's seen as the new locals coming down here. But we're getting people come down here who want to settle down and have children. It's security, a great place to raise kids, and a very safe place where, you'd certainly lock your door. The days of not locking your front door are well and truly gone in most places, but only just. It's just on the verge of having to do that. So it's a very safe and secure place where people keep an eye out for each other, and we're getting new young couples coming down here and buying their first home and settling down and starting to raise a family.
Does that mean that house prices aren't as mental there as they are in big chunks of Australia?
Well, it's all relative as well. One of the things that probably controls the house price down here is the ability to earn enough money to buy it as well. So although house prices, I think, are probably 10 or 15% cheaper than equivalent around Sydney or Melbourne or, regional areas around the capitals, you probably earn 15% less as from a wage as well. So that helps contain it. But look, nice houses bring good money, and the one that needs renovating is probably going to be a bargain.
Do you have any idea how much a 2 or 3 bedroom house in Huonville might cost? You mentioned there was a lot of real estate agents around. Have you been looking in the window?
Yeah, I always look in the window. I think the medium house price is probably around 300 or 350. That sort of price for a 2 or 3 bedroom house. And there's certainly houses down the road with signs up saying 230, 240. So they look like they're good buying.
If we can just return to my first question, which was about you, Andrew, and your family history. Can you give us a bit of a potted Smith family history in Huonville?
Well, our cider is actually named after the first guy who grew apples in our family, a guy called Willie Smith. And Willie married the daughter of a guy called Charles Oates. And Charles Oates was a convict. And Charles was smart enough when he was released as a convict to realise that all the convicts would get a land grant, which was 1 square mile of land. And Charles worked out that the other convicts may not want their 1 square mile of land and might not be able to work it. So he went and bought at a very cheap rate a whole pile of land off all his fellow convicts and started a flourishing business, cutting timber, a dairy farm, and an apple orchard, and became the eldest statesman of the Huon Valley originally. And Willie came and married one of his daughters, and that's where Willie was given a parcel of land with some apple trees on it. And so the Smith family apple business began. And 4 generations later, we've had a World War II veteran in there. We've had my father, who steered the ship through the demise of the industry through the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And now I'm taking over the business and trying to turn it into a value-added business and a certified organic apple orchard as well.
Any idea what Willie got transported for?
Look, there must have been a lot of sheep in the UK because I think someone was always stealing them. There seems to be I guess they were hungry. I mean, the true story is, I guess they were hungry. And I think a lot of these convicts, when you look at their history and what they did, they were actually not thieves. They were actually just hungry and generally stealing food, and were dealt with pretty harshly.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned there that you had some very enterprising forebears who kind of got into it and perhaps had the skills as well to sort of... can you tell us a bit about who else was around? I mean, was it really just Willie in the wilderness, or was there... Who were some of the other founding fathers and big families in the area?
Look, it was Charles Oates and the wilderness. When he came down here, he literally came with a horse and an axe and began clearing the land. And Charles, in his lifetime, became immensely successful and ended up with convict labour on his farm helping him run it. And subsequently, they built a majestic house, which my father lives in to this day, which is a beautiful double-storey stone house with, you know, 2-foot-thick walls. And Charles had 12 children. One tragically passed away at a young age, but ended up with 11 children who then produced 90 grandchildren.
Whoa.
And that's the valley. That was the emergence of this valley in the early 1800s.
Isn't that amazing when you think about that? That one family could grow in a couple of generations to be a population of a region to 100 and, you know, whatever people, and then they all marry someone, and that it really is the beginning.
It's incredible. It's incredible when you look at it. And we sometimes, you know, I'm very proud of what I'm doing down here, and I sometimes think, oh, I'm having a go. But when I look at history and I see what other people did with relatively no tools and no equipment and simply hard work, it's quite incredible. And the foresight that they must have had, because they were completely isolated down here, it really must have been at the end of the earth at that time. It was a 3-day trip on a horseback to Hobart from where we are.
How far is it now? And if we're planning a weekend or a long weekend in Hobart, and we're going to fly down and have a look at Mona and a mosey around, how do we get down there? Should we come down to Huonville?
Absolutely. I'd highly recommend it. We're 30 minutes south of Hobart. We're only, you know, 50 minutes from the airport. I have a running joke that says we're 50 minutes from the airport. People say, what time of day? It doesn't matter what time of day. This is Tasmania. We're only, it's 50 minutes whether you leave now or you leave at midnight.
Yeah, so, right. Okay.
And it's great. It's a great day trip, and you can do the full loop and come down through the Huon Valley and back up the Don Tricasso Channel. And if nothing else, you'll take in the beautiful scenery of Tasmania and all it has to offer.
You must get young couples who come down for... you know, lunch somewhere nice, to quaff a few wines and maybe buy a couple of bottles at some local wineries and then head back in the evening. That sounds like the perfect ticket to me.
Well, if I can blow my own trumpet for a little bit, we recently won Best Cider in Australia at the Australian Cider Awards, so you'd be having the best cider, and the winery next door won the best red wine in Australia as well, so we reckon we've got some pretty good product to offer if people come down here.
It sounds like it, and you've showed some excellent restraint, some very ABC-like restraint in not dropping any of those brand names. I thank you for that. Andrew Smith, thank you so much for being our virtual tour guide through Huonville this morning.
My pleasure, Tim.
Andrew Smith in Huonville in Tasmania, getting up very early to have yak to us and let us know what's going on in that part of the world. Yes, every week we head... somewhere new to a little town. We call it a spot on the map. Today's spot on the map was Huonville in Tasmania.